for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. Elena Kagan takes the oath tomorrow to become an associate justice on the Supreme Court, the first time three women will serve on the court at the same time. California Representative Maxine Waters presses the House Ethics Panel to set her trial date before the midterm elections in November. And President Obama visits a small business to talk about job creation as the government releases disappointing unemployment figures for July. Joining me in the studio for our Friday News Roundup, E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution. Welcome back, E.J.
Good to be here.
Margaret Talib of McClatchy Newspapers, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here also.
And joining the News Roundup for the first time, Stephen Dinan of the Washington Times. Welcome.
My pleasure.
Let's start with this California decision striking down Proposition 8, which the state passed, banning same-sex marriage. What was the judge's reasoning, Margaret?
Judge Walker's reasoning was that the law violates due process laws and federal equal protections. In other words, that it's discriminatory and unconstitutional.
Was it a surprise, EJ?
Not necessarily a surprise. This judge, first of all, he was first appointed by Ronald Reagan and then appointed to this job by the first President Bush. He's known as a kind of libertarian conservative. So it's not a shocking result. He has clearly written a decision, and Dahlia Lithwick made this point in an excellent piece on Slate. He's written a decision to appeal to Justice Kennedy. He's quoted Justice Kennedy's past decisions, and he really built an enormous factual record where he was trying to say, I went through this case very carefully. The anti-gay marriage side's facts really didn't stand up. And so he's appealing to one vote on the Supreme Court, assuming that the four liberals there would go with him, which maybe is not a safe assumption, but that's clearly what he's doing.
You know, the conclusion of the decision was very plain spoken. Sometimes you see these decisions, they're hard to understand, but this one was not one of those. He says, the evidence shows Proposition 8 does nothing more than enshrine in the California Constitution the notion that opposite-sex couples are superior to same-sex couples. So, Stephen, is this case headed to the Supreme Court?
Oh, I think absolutely. There's little doubt. It'll obviously have to go through the Ninth Circuit first, and there'll be likely a three-judge panel. We'll hear it, and then there will be a request, presumably, that it'll be heard en banc, and then eventually, yes, it reaches the Supreme Court. And we were talking earlier about Justice Kennedy, of course. One of the key things here is Justice Kennedy's decision in that Texas case from several years back about, I believe it was a sodomy case, and in that case, there was already some debate between Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia about exactly whether the ruling in that case set up the prospect of legalizing gay marriage nationwide through some subsequent case. And Justice Kennedy said, no, that's not what we're doing here. This does not presuppose that one way or the other. Justice Scalia said, yes, it certainly does. And we'll now see that play out.
Well, Margaret, this is less than 3 months before these critical midterm elections. Does it help or hurt one party or the other to have this issue back in the headlines?
I mean, I think you can argue that it will stir turnout on both sides of the aisle. But the question ultimately in elections is about turnouts. And in this case, it will be about who's more motivated to turn out. The left in the Democratic Party, who is not that enthusiastic about congressional elections until this point, or the conservative end of the Republican Party, who is typically more inclined to turn out in midterm elections than Democrats. I think it does have the potential to become a major turnout factor.
You know, Republicans in the past have sometimes found these social issues to be very useful in increasing turnout of their base voters. So are Republicans welcoming this time, EJ?
You know, it's complicated. I think the conventional wisdom is that the Republicans on net will gain more because of this decision, because social conservatives who aren't really part of the Tea Party, who aren't really part of that mobilization, will be mobilized to come out and vote on this. But Republicans are a little bit wary, especially in certain places, because precisely because some of the Tea Party folks are more libertarian. There was a poll done by Politico of a Tea Party rally a few months back where gay marriage was the very last issue on the list in importance put there by the Tea Party folks. So it's tricky in certain areas for the Republicans, and a lot of them were saying this week, we want to run on the economy and economics. We don't need this. But having said all that, it will be a motivator for the social conservatives.
Stephen, does it matter that this proposition was passed by a majority of California voters? It's not a law the legislature passed. It's something that came from the California electorate.
Sure, I think so. And I think, you know, to what EJ was saying a minute ago, part of what those Tea Party folks, there's no doubt that this is not high on their list, but what is high on their list is a sense of judges or, you know, President Obama, and in some cases they conflate the two, overturning or overruling the will of the majority. And in that sense, you know, just as it's not clear that the Tea Party folks were necessarily originally very interested in the immigration issue, but when you had the Obama administration suing to overturn Arizona's law, they became interested in it. I think that may be a factor here. In terms of which party benefits, I had dinner last night with a Republican operative who was gleeful over this, and his reaction was, "What more can go wrong for the Obama administration between now and November? This may be the icing on the cake." So that tells you something about where they see.
So what happens next, Margaret?
What happens next in terms of the ruling is that there will be there's an immediate process for both sides to make their case to the judge on how long he should stay his ruling. And then there's an appeals process. And as we're all sitting around here talking about it, everybody expects that appeals process to go to the court. But how quickly and under what precise circumstances and what other states do in the meantime is sort of up for grabs.
Now, there's a question from Howard. He posted it on the Diane Rehm Show website. He asks, can any party in the suit appeal a decision simply because they don't like the outcome of the case? EJ?
Well, they need some ground to appeal the decision. And I think that opponents of gay marriage will find some ground in the broad argument that this is a decision that should not be made in the courts. We're going to go back to some of the arguments that we had about Roe v. Wade, whether a decision like this is better reserved to the legislature or the people, or involves fundamental rights and should be decided by the court. And I think there's a whole interesting side debate, but it's a really important side debate on that question, where the judge's reasoning here was really airtight in the sense that he went through this trial record very, very, very carefully and said there's a fundamental right at stake here and no one gave grounds for overturning it. But there is, I think, a legitimate argument about the role of voters and legislatures in making decisions like this.
One of the things we learned with Roe v. Wade was the consequences, the continuing consequences politically from a Supreme Court decision. Well, while we're talking about the Supreme Court, let's talk about the confirmation yesterday of Elena Kagan to join the Supreme Court. Any surprises in the way the vote went, Stephen?
Not really any surprises. If you look at the last four confirmations, you sort of have a bracketing effect, though, where Chief Justice Roberts was confirmed. I believe it was 78 votes in favor of confirmation. You have Samuel Alito, who was confirmed with 58 votes. You had Justice Sotomayor, who was confirmed with 68 votes. And you now have bracketed in there between the Alito standard and the Sotomayor standard, essentially, soon to be Justice Kagan. So, you know, obviously there are different majorities playing there, but it's interesting in it's interesting to look at sort of placing these folks and seeing how they reached the court, what the view was of their political leaning, ideological leaning at that point based on those votes.
I thought a little bit of a surprise maybe that the Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown voted against her. What did you think, Margaret?
I thought the same thing. I thought that it was a choice that he didn't have to make, and he made it for a reason, and the reason was to make a statement and put his lot in with that of his party. And it's unclear what the consequences might be for him down the road. And it also makes sort of, talking about brackets, a bracketed statement to the other side of the coin, which is Lindsey Graham, crossing party lines to support her.
Our phone lines are open. You can reach us at 1-800-433-8850. EJ.
You know, Scott Brown is walking this really interesting line. He represents a state that is hardly part of the conservative base, put it mildly, my home state, in fact. And he has given some votes to the Democrats on a number of issues and then carefully tried to make sure that this conservative base that elected him still has something in his reelection. What's odd here is that he introduced Elena Kagan, said some really, really nice things about her. You can imagine he'll be questioned about that. But I think this vote shows we are having an enormous argument about the future of the court. We've had that before. We had it during the court packing fight during the New Deal. We had it in the progressive era. And this fight will be with us. And I think the progressives gained some ground in this argument that they handled the Kagan hearing much differently than they handled the Sotomayor hearing. They really got their argument out there that this conservative court is, with its sort of excessive respect for a certain notion of private property, is really doing the bidding of a lot of corporations, which brings us back to the same argument we had in the progressive era. And so we're going to see close votes, I think, again and again and again on these confirmations.
Now, her confirmation probably doesn't affect the ideology of the court very much. She's a liberal replacing a liberal. But, boy, you can see the prospects for a titanic battle if one of the more conservative justices were to step down and we have President Obama nominating his successor.
Well, and in particular, if we talked earlier about Justice Kennedy and his key role in what we expect to be this upcoming case on the California proposition, you know, if Justice Kennedy were to retire, that would open up the actual battle for that center seat. Just as a couple years ago, it was Justice O'Connor, when she retired, opened up that battle, and Justice Alito replacing her clearly had an effect on moving the court in a direction.
And of course, that would probably come at a time when President Obama would have fewer Democrats in the U.S. Senate, where we're joined by Stephen Dianen, who is the Congressional Bureau Chief for the Washington Times. Margaret Talib, she's the White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And E.J. Dionne, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a Washington Post columnist. We're going to go to the phones, take your calls and questions later in this hour. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And for our Friday News Roundup, we're joined by Margaret Talib of McClatchy Newspapers, E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution, and Stephen Dianen, Congressional Bureau Chief for the Washington Times. Job numbers out today. Somewhat disappointing, Stephen. What do they show?
They show a decline of about 131,000 jobs. In particular, the Census Bureau jobs that we staffed up on earlier this year have disappeared, and according to some folks, disappeared at a faster rate than they expected. Now, there are a couple of nuggets of good news for the economy in here. One is that the private companies added jobs which they've been adding for several consecutive months. And one particular nugget that I know Democrats are pointing to this morning is that manufacturing jobs also grew. I believe it's the seventh straight month of manufacturing job growth, which is the first time since 1998. So there are some key indicators that they're going to be able to point to. But overall, a grim picture that you had another you had more folks dropping out of the job search altogether and leaving the unemployed or underemployed or no longer even looking rate at the exact same, which is, you know, that's a very troublesome number there.
You know, I read yesterday that 4.3 million Americans are looking for jobs and have been looking for a job for at least a year. This unemployment situation just seems to be really resistant to getting better, EJ.
Right. Well, you know, in terms of the private sector jobs, better up than down. And there's a paradox here, which is the census is so efficient that it was able to drop people quicker than it thought it did, which then messes up these job numbers. A couple of things. One is the Obama administration, the Democrats, had been hoping that even if the unemployment number was going to be pretty high on Election Day, there would be, say, 4, 5, 6 months of 200,000 a month job growth, and that could have created a sense of momentum where even folks who were not happy with where the economy was would say, well, this is moving in the right direction. Well, it's moving in the right direction, broadly speaking, but at a much slower pace than they had hoped for. It was funny. I was talking to my sister last week and she was at an event in Rhode Island. It was a predominantly Democratic event. And what she said is, in this place with people who were generally favorably disposed toward Democrats, there was a kind of melancholy. That was a word she used. Rhode Island's been really hard hit by this downturn. And she said it was folks who were not so much angry as they wished it were moving faster. And I think that sense of, gee, can it move a little faster, is really out there in the country.
And, of course, the worst case would be if we slip back into recession. President Obama was asked yesterday if he was worried about a double-dip recession. He said he was confident that was not going to happen. But to a lot of people, this feels like we're still in a recession.
Right. That's why you see President Obama right now out on the trail hitting some of the only sort of arguable good news he can find, which, again, comes from government intervention, which is not the case that's going to spur huge confidence among some of those independent voters that he needs to motivate to turn out for his troops in the fall. And that is the bailout of the auto industry. But, I mean, okay, so he's been to GM, Chrysler, and Ford. There's no one else he can go see now. It's like time to move on. What are they going to say, right? And, again, in that case, the argument is we lost a million less jobs than we might have otherwise, not, wow, we're gangbusters. We've surpassed, you know, Toyota and Honda. So,
What I want to say is, as one of the only people who was not a member of the UAW or didn't live in Detroit who supported the bailout, I do think they have a lot to brag about there, because most people said, the government can't do this. They won't let the private companies behave like private companies. And lo and behold, they actually did a very good thing with this bailout. And they did let the private companies run like private companies. And as Obama's been saying, it's the first time since 2004 that all three of the big three are actually making money. Ford didn't get the bailout, but it supported the bailout because it was worried about side effects on suppliers and other things. So it is something they have a right to brag about.
You know, it's a tough argument to make, though. When I was young, I have three older brothers, and they used to, the oldest one in particular, used to pound me. And his argument was, meaner brothers would have hit you harder. That's essentially, you know, that's essentially the argument the Obama administration is left with here. Their argument is the recession was deeper than we thought. We've made it less worse than it could have been with the stimulus and with the government intervention. You know, the folks we were talking about earlier, the folks in Rhode Island and whatnot, aren't seeing it that way. They're like me, wondering, you know.
Well, their other argument is, we didn't start this, Bush did. And the polls show that despite all the Democrats' problems, and boy, do they have problems, people are still more inclined to blame the recession on President Bush than President Obama.
That's true, except that $862 billion stimulus, when you start talking about specifics.
$787 billion.
That was the original CBO adjusted the cost on that. But I mean, when you make that argument, there are very specific actions that the administration and Congress took at the administration's urging that they own at this point.
Now, there was some surprise action really this week in the Senate. The Senate overcame a filibuster to pass a $26 billion bill that helps states employ teachers, keep some state workers working. This was a little bit of a surprise that it got through.
Well, I think in many ways this could be a precursor for the tax extension fight that is going to brew later in the fall, which is Democrats saying, we're going to call the Republicans bluff and see if they really want to go on the record against you know, the middle class, teachers, whatever. And in this case, you have Nancy Pelosi telling the world by tweet that the House will come back from their fundraisers, their campaign stops, their family vacations to do the same. It was a bit of a surprise, but when you really step back and look at it, I don't think anybody wanted it's not so much the Medicaid, which has got months more to run, but those loss of the teachers on their hands.
Now, the two Republican senators from Maine supported this bill that enabled the Democrats to get over the filibuster. Why did they support it?
Well, first of all, there was an enormous amount of advertising and organizing in Maine by the teachers' unions and by a lot of other folks saying, look, here's what's going to happen in Maine if this doesn't go through. Here is the potential threat in terms of layoffs here, in terms of state budget problems if you don't get the long-term Medicaid money. And I think that had some real impact on them. They are the two who are going to be on the griddle on almost everything, along with Scott Brown. I think the one unfortunate thing about this is the money to support this, some of it comes out of food stamps, a $50 a month boost in food stamps for very poor people. I've talked to Democrats who say, look, we had to do it that way. That doesn't really kick in until 2014, when either the economy will be going better or we'll find another way to get that money to them. But they really had to bend and shape the budget to cover the costs of this to get it through.
In particular, they had to cut about $2 billion out of the stimulus, which is that's a major step they've taken there. Until this point, the administration and Democrats in both chambers have been pretty successful at keeping down every effort. Republicans repeatedly offered to pay for stuff through stimulus, and they've been very good at beating down every single one of those efforts. Now, all of a sudden, they're essentially acknowledging that there is a pot of money there that they can go to. And it's actually funny, later yesterday, Republicans offered another amendment to pay for something out of stimulus, and Senator Schumer took to the floor. This is on a border security spending measure. Senator Schumer took the floor and said, we should not be cutting money out of the job producing stimulus. And Senator McCain said, you realize you just did that earlier today. So this, you know, the administration originally opposed a similar move in the House when it was attached to the war spending bill. They had actually had a veto threat on it because of some of the stimulus money that it cut. But the administration has come out, they've issued a statement of policy supporting, at least supporting in general, what the Senate's doing here. So it'll be an interesting test. If the president signs a bill that actually redirect stimulus, then all bets are off for using stimulus for more in the future.
What the administration opposed in that House bill was some of the money came out of their Race to the Top education program, and they wanted to take a stand for that. I think it reflected some bad negotiating between David Obie and the administration. I'm saying that more that the administration, Obie was impatient with the fact that the administration had not really come out as strongly as he thought they should have in favor of this money for the teachers.
No, that's definitely true, although we've repeatedly asked them whether they would support some of the other Republican proposals to cut from the stimulus, and the White House has told us they'd opposed all of those. They said let the Stimulus Act go into effect as written.
There's another economic debate that is starting to heat up. It's not going to be concluded until at least this fall, maybe even in a lame duck session of Congress, and that is the question of whether to extend those Bush tax cuts that expire at the end of the year. We saw an early skirmish on this front this week. EJ, tell us about it.
Well, this is going to be one of the most interesting and important philosophical and political arguments of the year. And, you know, question number one, will the Democrats cave and back some extension of the tax cuts for the rich? We're talking here about Democrats saying we want to extend all the tax cuts for people earning under $250,000. We only want to stop the ones for over that. And it's worth noting that for people earning, say, $300,000 or $400,000, they'll still keep most of their tax cut because they're only paying it on the money on top of the $250,000. Republicans are saying this is bad for the economy. Democrats are saying, wait a minute, aren't you guys who keep talking about the deficit, but you don't care about the deficit as long as it's money going to the very rich? So I think you had a setup this week for what will be one of the central arguments in the fall.
And you saw Senate Republicans trying to focus the question on the impact on small businesses, Stephen?
Right. Their argument is that since so many small businesses file as S-chapter corporations, you know, the the finances are mixed, the business and the personal finances. Their argument is that this will hurt small business at the time that you don't want to hurt small business in the middle of recovery. Now, the numbers actually suggest, and Secretary Geithner, Treasury Secretary Geithner made the argument this week that you're actually talking about, as best as they can tell, maybe only 3% of small businesses getting hit by this tax increase. So there are all sorts of questions about the actual numbers. You know, two things that are interesting. First is that what EJ mentioned, there's essentially 97% agreement on 97% of the tax cuts. And that's an incredible, an incredible outcome 10 years after the Bush tax cuts. The other problem, and it's exactly what EJ mentioned, Republicans have a real messaging problem here with the focus they've made on the deficit. This Senator John Kyle, the number two Republican senator, a couple weeks ago on one of these Sunday talk shows actually sort of goofed up on this issue and just did not answer the question very well. He said, no, tax cuts are different. It's not about the deficit. We can't deal with increasing taxes right now. You know, there's a philosophical argument to be made about the government should take X amount of money and then figure out where to spend it. And that, of course, goes up against the other argument, which is the government should figure out what it needs to spend and then go back and get that money from taxpayers. There's a philosophical argument to be made on behalf of that first argument that the government should first decide how much, you know, what it needs to spend or what it should take and then go spend that. But the Republicans are not doing a good job of explaining it.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to go to the phones now and take some of your calls. 1-800-433-8850. Give us a call on our toll-free line. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. Well, let's start by talking to Sonny. He's calling us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Sonny, welcome to The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. Good morning. I want to go to the case that was decided in California this week on gay marriage.
Uh-huh.
And first of all, I am a Mormon, and so I come from that perspective. And I feel like this was a blow to the democracy that was taking place by the voters expressing in a very clear way their desire to change the Constitution in that state, and then that being overruled by a judge. And I want to make it clear that I don't feel, and I don't think other Mormons feel, like this is a case of civil rights, because they have the right to marry. And unfortunately, they don't have the desire to marry within the framework that's available. But they do have that same right as everyone else. And it comes down to what is right and wrong. And unfortunately, this is a moral argument that's being played out in the courts under the guise of a civil rights argument. And unfortunately, there's a tug and a pull, and I think it's going to probably come down at the end of the day on the wrong side from my perspective. But I also have been labeled as a people, you know, as other Mormons and other conservatives, as a bigot and as a small-minded individual. And, you know, I am very, very sick of that argument. And it holds no weight. It does not apply to me because I don't have any malice or any desire to take anything away from any other individual. But I do have a strong desire to protect what I believe is a very, very important part of our society, and that is traditional marriage.
All right, Sonny, thanks so much for your call. EJ.
Well, as Sonny made an interesting argument I hadn't heard before. He's essentially saying, if I heard him right, that gay people have the same right to heterosexual marriage as everybody else. But that's not exactly what's relevant to gay people. There is a lot of overheated language in this discussion, and I think this is a hard issue for the following reason. If you are gay and you want to get married and you want to make your life commitment to someone who is of the same sex, in most places you can't do it. I came to support gay marriage myself on what I would call conservative grounds, which is, and David Brooks made this argument very powerfully years ago, that if you believe in fidelity and commitment, why should you deny to gay people the possibility of making these commitments? But on the other side is this argument about democracy, that this is the kind of issue that should not be settled by the courts, and that we should argue it out in the democratic system. We have, I think, 5 states in one way or another who have either gotten it through the courts or gotten it through the legislature, and the voters have accepted it. In the long run, I still think that all of this is going to have to be ratified by legislatures and the voters. In the long run, I think we're going to move to gay marriage because young Americans have very different views on this than older Americans. But that's, I think, a legitimate argument that we're going to have in the coming months.
You know, it's also true that this is an issue on which we are we're seeing big changes in U.S. public opinion in the polling. There's a poll, I think it was a field poll in California, that showed that the Proposition 8 would not pass if it was presented today, that a majority of California voters don't support it. Margaret?
It is changing. It's changing over time. It's changing generationally. But I think one of the most interesting places where you see this tension is in President Obama's own position himself, which is that he supports pretty much all other gay rights but opposes gay marriage.
Now, why is that, do you think?
Well, I mean, I'd love to ask him. Maybe I'll get a chance at the next press conference. But it's unclear. He has not been explicit about whether he's just old-fashioned or whether his opposition is one of, I lead the country and the country isn't ready for this yet, and I don't see that it's a necessity to have the battle at this time. It's unclear to me precisely why he has the position he has.
Now, David calls us from Baltimore, Maryland, and asks, if Proposition 8 goes to court, is there an effect on other states, those other states that have permitted gay marriage, or the states that now bar gay marriage? Stephen, do you know the answer to that?
I imagine this is a federal district ruling right now, but I imagine if the Ninth Circuit agrees with the decision and agrees that Proposition 8 is unconstitutional, it'll be interesting to see. But I imagine there is some way at that point at which that ruling obviously applies to the entire Ninth Circuit.
Of course, it's unconstitutional under the California Constitution, so I guess that issue would not apply to other states. I'm actually not that informed on this, so I should probably stop talking about it.
I think the issue here is that if local courts based their rulings on state constitutions, the federal government can't tamper. The federal decision wouldn't tamper with that. If state legislatures or voters pass gay marriage ordinances, I doubt the Supreme Court will say that they're not free to do that. This will only declare, if the court goes the other way, that there's no federal right to gay marriage embedded in the Constitution.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll go to the phones, we'll take some of your calls, and we'll talk about some good news this week on the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. In Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai calls for a probe of the U.S.-backed anti-corruption task force. The Taliban claims responsibility for killing a top Pakistani security official. And a hip-hop star plans to run for president of Haiti. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. The oil giant BP has finished pumping cement into its well in the Gulf of Mexico, and with the hope of sealing it off for good, the government issued a report that said 3/4 of the oil from the spill has been taken care of. This was kind of a surprise to a lot of us that so much of the oil, according to this government report, has either evaporated or been skimmed. EJ, some controversy, I guess, over whether this report is entirely credible.
May I invoke Ronald Reagan, trust but verify? I think there's a lot of skepticism around because so much of the information we got in the first instance turned out to be wrong. In the second instance, I have no doubt that some of this oil was skimmed off. They were doing a lot of work on that, that some of it has dispersed. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is even on the optimistic side, there's still something like 50% of this oil out there. I've heard the number 50% widely used. Even 25% of this sitting in the Gulf is still an awful lot of oil. So I think we're going to be talking about the impact of this, the long-term impact of this for a long time.
Now, the amount that is remaining under this government estimate is still four times the size of the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989.
Yeah.
So you're saying still a lot of oil.
Plug the hole, to quote the president. That is good news.
They still need to have to finish this relief well before we can say this crisis is over.
And then there are still questions about what BP intends to do with it long term. So I think that some of the most important concerns or objections to the government report only partly have to do with the percentage estimates and have a lot to do with the spin and the timing and the method and the reason why it was brought out when it was brought out. Because if you if you read the report and if you ask the scientists questions, including the NOAA administrator, they all acknowledge when pressed that there are major unknowns and major concerns that they have personally, things that will take years to determine about the effects on the food chain, effects on health and safety, and so forth. So when you read the fine print, the government readily acknowledges many unanswered questions and concerns.
Let's go back to Capitol Hill. The Maxine Waters, the congresswoman from California, called this week for making the ethics charges against her public. She'd like to have her public trial before the midterm elections. Stephen, what's happening here?
Well, so that's right. Just after the House had left for its 6-week summer vacation, the Ethics Committee made public these charges that had been expected. And she, as you said, she wants to go for a public trial. She says that this is she did nothing wrong here. The case is essentially a little bit of history. It was brought by the Office of Congressional Ethics, which is this new body that was set up when Congress, the House decided to get its ethics house in order and actually working and get the Ethics Committee working again. It was recommended to the Ethics Committee. An investigative panel has decided that she should, in fact, a charge should be lodged against her on whether she essentially the accusation is that she made a call to the Treasury Department to try and get a meeting between bank officials and Treasury officials. And when they actually had the meeting, the main bank they talked about was one in which her husband was invested.
Now, the Ethics Committee already has plans for a public trial of Charlie Rangel, the New York congressman, sometime this fall. Is it likely they'll be able to do both of these?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's the investigative work is essentially done at this point. The case has been established by investigative committees. So now it's a matter of actually going through the motions of the trials. I mean, the real question is how eager are Democratic leaders to have both of these trials going on? How eager are the two lawmakers to force public trials to make their cases and where we go from there?
So how eager are Democratic leaders, Jay, to have these two trials going on this fall?
The one thing you cannot accuse Democrats of on this is timing it for political reasons, because the last thing I think any Democrat up for re-election this year wants is a trial or two trials in September. And Democrats are actually turning around and trying to make lemonade out of lemons and saying, look, the fact that we're willing to bring these cases shows we're making the ethics process work. We are trying to clean our house. I salute them for this brave effort to turn the issue around. I'm not sure what effect it's going to have, but it's sort of interesting to see them make that argument. And as I say, it is true. If you really wanted to bury these, you'd do it somewhere in mid-December, right before Christmas.
Now, this is we've gotten several emails along the lines of this one. This particular one comes from Russ, who writes us from Princeton Junction, New Jersey. He says, I don't understand why the Democrats are the focus of this media feeding frenzy about their supposed ethics scandals. Why does the media never bracket the scandal involving Republican Senator John Ensign with the two Democratic members of Congress? His behavior certainly looks unethical, and it even has a sex component, which usually the media finds highly worthy of coverage. Margaret?
I think it might be selective readership or viewership on his part. I think there's been a tremendous amount of spotlight on Senator Ensign's issues. And these cases, particularly Mr. Rangel's case, you know, have been ongoing and are fairly serious in terms of allegation and probably deserve extensive spotlighting and coverage.
Yeah, I mean, if Senator Ensign, it's our understanding that there is an ethics process, still an investigation in the Senate underway. The reason why these are getting so much attention is because charges have actually been lodged. Normally, in situations like this, deals are cut beforehand. In both of these cases, the lawmakers said, "No, we want a public trial. We want to have this heard. We don't think we've done anything wrong, and in fact, believe in some instances we're being targeted unfairly." So they're the ones who are pushing for this to go through. And it's a rare occasion. You know, the last time we had this was Representative Traficant, I believe 2002-2003 timeframe. And so it's a rare thing that we're actually going through this. If it reaches that point with Senator Ensign, I imagine you will definitely see the same coverage.
The progressive blogs have been doing a very aggressive job to make sure that Senator Ensign gets mentioned as often as possible when this story comes up. And this emailer shows how successful that effort is. And we are talking about Senator Ensign.
That's right. And we did get multiple emails along the same lines. Well, here's an email from Scott in Doswell, Virginia. He says, concerning the extension of the Bush tax cuts, why are we even having this conversation? And by that, I mean, why was a sunset clause even inserted into the original bill? EJ?
Because it was cheating. Basically, the Democrats in the Senate won a kind of victory, allied with moderate Republicans, holding down the size of the tax cut when it was passed initially. In order to cram more tax cut into the bill than the actual numbers allowed, they put the 10-year sunset on it, and it made the issue come up again. As I remember, there also had something to do with Senate budget rules that they had to do it within the 10-year period. So it was an exploding time bomb. The most interesting one, of course, is that right now there is no inheritance tax, no estate tax in the country, yet the full estate tax as it existed 10 years ago takes effect on January 1st this year. Paul Krugman of the New York Times referred to this as the Throw Grandma Off the Train Act, because suddenly the estate tax on January 1, if they do nothing, is going to be very different than the zero estate tax on December 31st.
One can only imagine how much the family of George Steinbrenner.
What a
say.
Lucky man. Yes. I mean, if he's going to, I mean, not that he
way,
died,
yes,
but
right.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's go to Mark. He's calling us from Dallas. Mark, hi.
Hello. How are y'all doing today?
Good.
I just wanted to make the comment on a previous caller talking about, again, the gay marriage issue. The previous caller had made an important point, I think, in that admitted that this is a moral argument being argued in our courts, which has always gone to my view on this issue, that this attempt to outlaw gay marriage is merely the religious people trying to impose their views on a secular nation. So being a moral argument being argued in our courts, which are necessarily secular, I think the judge made the right decision by saying that specific religions do not get to determine fundamental rights for the rest of our nation.
All right, Mike. Mark, thanks very much for your call. You know, we've gotten several emails and callers on the subject. William in Narrative, New Hampshire, I've never been to Narrative, but I like the name a lot, says, everyone seems to be upset about the democratic process. The founding fathers did it on purpose. The rights of the individual can't be overthrown by the majority, making the point that even though this was passed by a referendum, that doesn't necessarily apply. And Andrea from Elkhart, Indiana, sends us an email that says, if courts hadn't overturned the will of the majority, we would still have segregated schools and white-only lunch counters.
You know, there's a long academic study, long academic literature on this issue, as EJ was talking about earlier, about the conflict between the will of the majority and the courts. And there's certainly been a lot of research done on abortion in particular, 1970, the Roe v. Wade ruling, and whether that has left the sides more polarized here in the United States than in other countries where they've come to some sort of legislative solution for how to handle the issue of abortion. And we may be facing exactly that again here.
We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Los Angeles and talk to Martin. Hi, Martin.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
About Eugene, Miss Waters, you call it a trial. It's irritating to me to hear that. It's an investigative hearing. she's not going to jail if she's found guilty. It's not a judicial trial. So I don't know why that the media continues calling it a trial.
All right, Martin, thanks for your call. Stephen?
Well, the caller makes an interesting point. It is technically it's an adjudicatory panel because the Ethics Committee has two processes it goes through. The first is that it convenes an investigative panel, which is peers of colleagues of the lawmaker who go through and do an investigation with heavy help from the professional staff there. And then in order to have a fair process, they then present their findings. And it is essentially an adversarial system. The investigators become the prosecutorial side, essentially, and the defense, the lawmaker who against whom the charges are lodged becomes the defense. Now, the caller's right that there's no jail time imposition here, but the penalties range up to expulsion.
Expulsion. And what other penalties could be imposed?
Reprimand, admonishment. Back with Tom DeLay, the former Republican House Majority Leader, he was repeatedly admonished for various transgressions. That's sort of the low level of punishment. And then a representative trafficant, who we talked about earlier, of course, was expelled.
We were talking about the California decision on same-sex marriage based in part on the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Interesting, the 14th Amendment very much in the news this week. Another segment of the 14th Amendment under debate with this suggestion by some leading Republicans that we ought to take another look at the idea that if you're born in the United States, you automatically get citizenship. EJ, what's the issue?
Well, the 14th Amendment says, and I quote, that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens. And this was put in play by a surprising person, really. Lindsey Graham really gave this a push. Lindsey Graham has always supported the idea of a comprehensive immigration reform. He's worked hard on it. And yet he came out and said, people come here to have babies. They come here to drop a child. It's called drop and leave. Now, I got to say that the term drop a child is pretty offensive. And, Lindsey Graham is a right to lifer. I don't know how you can use that phrase, drop a child. The fact, I'm sorry, I have a frog in my throat. The fact is that those who say this was not intended by the 14th Amendment, well, yes, at the time we had very few, virtually no immigration laws, so they weren't illegal immigrants to the country. On the other hand, the issue of immigration did come up, and President Andrew Johnson, who was opposed to the 14th Amendment, talked about how it would, and I'm quoting, talked about that it would include gypsies, it would include the Chinese of the Pacific states. So the immigration issue really did come up, and I think and Garrett Epps, whom I cited in my column, a law professor, did research, and it's pretty clear that it was intended to cover everybody except for Indians who had separate Native Americans who had separate citizenship and the kids of diplomats. I think it's a shame this has come up. Republicans should be proud of their role in creating the 14th Amendment, and I hope this issue disappears.
Well, Stephen, why is it coming up now?
Well, it's not exactly a new issue. Every time the immigration issue heats up, and boy, has that issue heated up this year, every time that issue heats up, this does pop up. I remember doing a story, it was either 2005 or 2006, when then-Speaker Denny Hastert for the Republicans decided that he actually backed ending birthright citizenship, as it's called. So it's not necessarily new. It's just that there's a huge segment of the population that doesn't understand, that doesn't want this policy and would like to overturn the policy. So it will always come up during immigration debates.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Well, so let's talk about an issue that has really divided people in New York City and really across the country. It's a proposal to build a mosque near the site of Ground Zero, and a big step forward in this proposal this week with the decision by the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission not to protect the building that would be torn down to create the site for this mosque and some other facilities on the grounds that it was, for historic reasons, needed to be preserved. Margaret, what's happening in New York with this debate?
I mean, it is a hugely divisive issue, and Mayor Bloomberg stepped in on the side of the Cordoba Initiative group and of their right to proceed as planned. But it's a hugely divisive issue along very emotional lines, clearly tied to 9/11 and people's grief. And the White House itself has sort of punted to this point, saying that it's an issue for locals to resolve.
EJ?
You know, no one spoke more eloquently on this issue than President George W. Bush. He gave a very powerful speech at the Islamic Center after 9/11, talking about our respect for the rights of our fellow Americans who are Muslims. At another occasion, he said, America treasures the relationship we have with our many Muslim friends, and we respect the vibrant faith of Islam. I think this is a very unfortunate fight. I'd love to see George W. Bush speak out on this, because I think one of the best things he did was right after 9/11, he said, let's be careful about demonizing all of Islam. That's wrong.
And yet even the Anti-Defamation League, which of course has a long history of standing up for the civil rights of Jews and of others, came out this week saying this is not the right place to put this mosque.
Right. And that's essentially the issue, is whether the group itself should show deference to the will. You know, I think it was a Siena College poll this week said 62% of New Yorkers don't want to see this built there. The question is whether the group should essentially let its legal argument go. It may very well have the legal right to do this, but should it let that go out of respect for what happened there? And, you know, you've had folks on either side. Their argument, the group's argument is this is a way of trying to continue to bridge the gap that obviously still exists. And that's a very powerful argument.
Stephen Dynan, he's Congressional Bureau Chief for The Washington Times. We've also been joined this hour by Margaret Talib, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and E.J. Dionne, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a Washington Post columnist. Thank you all for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.